I wanna know what's carnival for. Going down in your lane, I've got my ticket in my hand. Going down in your lane, I've got my ticket in my hand. When I get in your lane, I wanna see the Zulu King. Down on the rampart in Dumaine. Yes, down in your lane, on the rampart in Dumaine. Gonna make it my standing place until I see the Zulu Queen.
That's Professor Longhair from a reissue of Sides Done for Atlantic on Atlantic, a tune called Mardi Gras in New Orleans. I'm Bob Carlin, and with me today is Nicholas Spitzer, who was for six and a half years the state folklorist in Louisiana and is currently the folklorist, one of the folklorists at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. He's produced a number of records and films and festivals on Louisiana music and Louisiana culture. If you're a longtime Philadelphia resident, you might have heard him on the radio when he was folk music director for WXPN in the early 1970s, or on WMMR in the period of around 1973 and 1974.
That real halcyon era in Philadelphia radio.
That's right.
Well, it seems like it's good now. You've got such a great program here, so it's good to be back.
Well, thank you, Nick. I've allowed Nick free rein here today and set him loose in our record library, and he's pulled out some sounds of New Orleans and Louisiana, and hopefully we'll get him to talk a little bit about the musical traditions in
Louisiana. Yeah, I kind of was hoping maybe we could get into some Gulf South kind of sounds, sort of move along through French Louisiana, New Orleans, and maybe a little bit, Caribbean. But Southern Louisiana is kind of an extension of the Caribbean culturally, the way it was settled, the people that mingled there. And so it's nice to kind of hear the comparison and hear some of the music. And also, of course, Mardi Gras is coming up on the 12th of February, and we were listening to Professor Long here with his classic anthem to Mardi Gras, still very popular in the city, played, you know, almost 24 hours a day, along with other Mardi Gras music. But I was thinking maybe it'd be kind of interesting for people to hear some of the country Mardi Gras sound that they don't usually hear out southwest of New Orleans, out on the prairies where the Cajuns and Black Creoles live. So that's what we tuned into next here, I think.
Mm-hmm. How does Professor Longhair, Henry Bird, fit into the whole musical picture, the gumbo of music down there in Louisiana?
Well, he's certainly one of the greatest American musicians in this century. his keyboard style, his rhythms are very strongly influenced by a Caribbean sound that you hear in a lot of New Orleans music, weak beat accents, lots of syncopation. And then, he's not unlike sort of the Barrel House piano man, the man and his piano kind of entertainer, playing in the brothels and the sporting parlors of New Orleans and that sort of thing. And Longhair is kind of in a lineage that leads from Toots Washington into, beyond him to Fats Domino and Alan Toussaint. So he's in a tradition of New Orleans keyboard men, but he's the most Afro-Caribbean sounding of all of them, I think. Of course, there's Dr. John, too, influenced by him quite a bit.
What's country Mardi Gras like? We were just talking a little bit about city Mardi Gras versus the country cousins. What's the difference between what we see on the news as far as Mardi Gras in New Orleans versus the country Mardi Gras?
Well, the New Orleans Mardi Gras has the big float parade. That's the most famous side of it. Of course, that represents some of the old elite crews, Comus and Momus and such as that, and they have nighttime parades with torches, and they call it flambeau. There's also a major black parade called Zulu, which was a response to white stereotypes around the turn of the century, and it's a blackface parade in which blacks go in blackface, a very fascinating, fun parade. Then there's also the Mardi Gras Indians, who are some of the street black communities' parades that do very Caribbean kind of chanting and singing, and we might find something a little similar to that as we go on here. That's in the city, though. Out in the country, you've got more of the tradition taken after mumming from Central Europe, from Western Europe, and people go house to house in search of chickens, live chickens that they will chase. They go in a variety of costumes, men as women, men as all kinds of trickster figures and devils and things like that, animals. And at each house, a captain asks permission in French to come into the yard, and then they're admitted to the yard, usually by the householder. Someone throws out a live chicken after the men dance together, and they chase the chicken, grab it, kill it. Can be kind of bloody. And they pick up other things, sausage, grease, rice, and they invite the people from the house back to a big dance at night. And they get back on their horses or on their trucks, and they head back. And they go out on this maybe 20, 30-mile romp during the day, dancing, drinking, getting chickens. And by the end of the evening, it's dance time, and everyone who's given comes to the dance, kind of a communal dinner and dance. And then at midnight, Lent. So it all shuts down. So it's kind of a movable feast. In New Orleans, people wait for the parade to kind of come down a street and get their trinkets and such. And out in the countryside, the parade goes out to the people's homes, I guess you could say.
Do you get luck by contributing to the gumbo pot on Mardi Gras?
You show that you're part of the community and that you're willing to give and and come eat. And, it's sort of all for one kind of thing and participation. The chant we've got here is a rural black Creole Mardi Gras chant. People have probably heard of the Ardoin family. This is from the Ardoin family. Boisec Ardoin and Canray Fontenot are the leaders here. And this is a chant where you'll hear the men singing. The response is, Webon cher camarade, which means, yes, my dear friend, or yes, my good friend. And then you'll hear him really lining out. The leader of the chant will be saying, once a year to give a chicken's not so bad, just a little skinny chicken. Come on, our gumbo's weak. We really need your help. That's the kind of lines like that. And you'll hear the men chanting in response and a little music to dance to.
Bon gambo,
oui mon cher camarade.
Et ouais, tu gagnes mon essai.
Oui mon cher camarade.
Et mon
adresse, oui, mon cher camarade.
pas, non, c'est pas souvent.
Oui, mon cher camarade.
Un gombo de mon frère.
Oui, mon cher camarade.
Un gombo de mon frère.
Oui, mon cher camarade.
Petit grain en nous en.
Oui, mon cher camarade.
Oh!
Little bit of the sounds of Louisiana with the Ardoin Family Orchestra. That's interesting. We heard first from an album that my guest Nick Spitzer put together. It's called Zodico, I believe you would pronounce it.
Zodico.
Louisiana, the music of Louisiana Creoles, and that's a Rounder record release. And then on Sonnet, an import from England, we heard the Ardoin Family Orchestra, same group, but instead of with Kenroy Fontenot playing fiddle, we heard White Fiddler,
Dewey
Balfa from the Balfa family, doing a Spanish tune, La Cucaracha. What is exactly the whole interplay between the Spanish and the French and the Creole? I mean, what's the cultures like in Louisiana? And they all kind of mix together down there, don't they?
Yeah, that southern Louisiana region is more like the Caribbean than the American South. Some people say it's south of the South. I mean, if you take New Orleans, which is the jewel city of the Gulf Coast, it is really much more like Lima, Peru, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, than it is like Nashville or Atlanta. But the whole Gulf Coast, even in Mississippi and southern Alabama, has elements of this mingling of European cultures and African cultures. In southwest Louisiana, the Cajuns are the descendants of the Acadians that came in the 18th century as exiles. The Black Creoles, as they're now called, are a mingling culturally and ancestrally of the Acadians, the Cajuns, some Spanish and Indian and Black. And so they're an interesting mixture and style. The music Zydeco is really an Afro-French music. It just so happens, though, that they're proximate enough to old Spanish Texas and the Gulf Coast, and they can hear the radio stations across the Gulf of Mexico. So people like tunes like La Cucaracha and La Paloma and a bunch of others, and they hear it, and then they end up with this kind of thing, which is, you know, a Cajun fiddler with a Black French Zydeco kind of country band doing a Spanish tune. But that's the way it is in that sort of circum-Caribbean Gulf Coast along there. It's real fascinating for that.
The Creole people, people of color in Louisiana, are a really separate culture from the Blacks in the American South.
Mm-hmm.
You did this album of the Creole music. You also produced a film that's been on public television in Louisiana about that culture. How is it different from Black culture?
Well, for one thing, a lot of the people speak Creole or Cajun French. Creole is an Afro-French language similar to what's spoken in Haiti and Martinique and French West Africa. The people are Catholic rather than Protestant for the most part, though there are some Protestants among the Creoles. Their folk traditions tend to be more from Senegal, Senegambia area, the basin, and to some degree, Dahomey in the Congo. They came in through the French West Indian slave trade rather than the British trade. The British trade, you think of the Gullah, the people on the Sea Islands, Georgia and South Carolina, they're speaking that Gullah speech is Atlantic Creole. That's the British Afro mix. This is the French Afro mix. So there were different ethnic groups from Africa, and then they met different people here in the U.S. Or in the Gulf South, the French. So they split from the American Blacks because of that ancestry and cultural difference.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of Creole or Black influence or intermingling with the white cultures? Are they very separate in Louisiana?
Well, to be Creole usually means that you have some kind of European ancestry and sense of culture to some degree. And so a lot of the Creoles, you know, consider themselves, they don't think of themselves as Black Americans all the time. Sometimes they think of, you know, Creole as sort of a multiple racial, ancestral, cultural category. So they, you know, kind of have that sense to them. But there is a lot of mingling in style in a variety of ways. I mean, as we'll hear in some of the music that we're going to play, we have a lot of overlap between Black, white, and in between. When we get to some of our Nathan Abshire, for example, you're going to hear a white Cajun band doing basically a Black blues sound with a little bit of a Zydeco beat. So there's a lot of overlap. And, you know, New Orleans jazz is essentially a Creole music. It was a mingling of African folk style with European melodic approach, you know. So that's just the way things are. It's the way it is in the food, the architecture, the music, the language, and the way people look. Some people are, you know, actually, you know, mixed people as well as being culturally mixed. Mm-hmm. So.
You were the state folklorist for Louisiana for 6.5 years, and I'm wondering if they brought you in with the reasons for bringing you in. Did they bring you in because there was a strong feeling that they wanted to preserve the culture of Louisiana, or did you help to create that feeling, do you think?
Well, I'd like to think I did. Actually, they didn't bring me in. I brought myself in. I'd done some field work down there. I did this album, Zydeco, before I was a state folklorist. I had only lived in rural French Louisiana. I didn't know what it would be like moving to Baton Rouge, which is kind of a border town and the state capital between North and South Louisiana. It's on the Mississippi, and it's a big petrochemical center, and it's the home of Louisiana's great politics and crazy politics, Edwin Edwards and all the amazing governors that have come through from Huey Long on down. But it is, interestingly enough, Louisiana, because of its isolation, has a very strong folk tradition continuing both the north and the south part of the state. But at the same time, because it was isolated, Louisiana didn't pick up on some of this cultural revival, the inness of roots and ethnicity, as much as the rest of the country. And so at the same time as there was a great richness of culture there, there was very little public concern about preserving the culture. And the man that ultimately had hired me with the State Arts Agency was an outsider as well. And most of the major cultural preservationists in Louisiana until a few years ago were outsiders. Ralph Rinsler from the Smithsonian did a great deal of work there in the 60s, for example, helped get the Balfa Brothers going and encouraged the revival of Cajun music. That doesn't mean there aren't many Louisiana people that are deeply concerned about the culture, but it's been a real struggle to get Louisiana people and politicians and others to really support the cultural revival. It's a very it's sort of a pioneer plantation feudalistic society that kind of is just now coming into the New South, and it's a funny mixture of things, and doesn't have strong institutions to do that kind of preservation. It's better than it was, but there's a long way to go there yet. And interest from people like you in Philadelphia and elsewhere around the country from the outside has always spurred people down there to feel better about it all and do more with their culture.
Is there any feeling when you were there of feeling ashamed of the culture and ashamed of the French language and the heritage?
Well, that's largely passé. I think that really moved away in the late 60s. The Cajuns did better than almost anybody in making a cultural comeback because they were so distinctive. Among the black Creoles, it's been much more recent than there's been an interest in the cultural revival following the Cajuns. There are other groups like the Spanish people in Louisiana, Isleños from the Canary Islands that live down below New Orleans, are just now really getting into looking at their speakers of ancient Canary Island Spanish. Interestingly enough, the groups in the state that are the least responsive to a sense of cultural revival are the old black American, Anglo-American cultures. They kind of live outside the romanticism of the Mississippi Delta and the Appalachian Mountain South, and they've always just kind of felt like, well, we're not that, nor are we Cajun and French and southern Louisiana. And in some ways, even though that was not my original interest, I got much more interested in trying to help the old line Anglo and black populations to kind of get into their whole thing. But there are many other groups there, and it's all at sort of a variety of layers of how much interest in revival there is. For example, recently the Italians, of course, who are a very large group in Philly, have made a big comeback with interest in their St. Joseph altars and their foodways and how they've mixed with the French. You know, there's the Italian Cajun. So it's a lot of different layers of revival going on.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Nicholas Spitzer, who was for 6.5 years the state folklorist in Louisiana and is now a folklorist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. We're going to hear a little Cajun music and come back and talk a little more. I've allowed Nick to go into the record library here at 91 FM at WHYY and pull out some of his favorite Gulf Coast music. This is a Nathan Abshire cut, isn't it?
That's right. We've got Pine Grove Blues coming up here.
Okay. Why don't we listen to that and talk a little bit about Cajun music and Pine Grove Blues.
Thank you. La prochaine danse, on va jouer à Alain Lafayette.
That's Octa Clark and Hector Duhon off of a Rounder LP that my guest Nick Spitzer helped put together. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Nathan Abshire and Mr. Octa and Mr. Hector,
how they
fit into the Cajun music picture.
Well, Nathan's from Basile and, of course, passed away a few years ago and reflects that mingling of blues and French that you get on the Cajun and the Creole side, black influence and French influence together. Pine Grove Blues, certainly one of his big ones there. And, you know, you got the full old, they call them the Pine Grove Boys, which is basically the Boffa Brothers backing him up for the most part. And then Octa and Hector doing One of the first songs ever recorded in Cajun music, Allons à Lafayette, Joe Falcone originally did it in 28, and an updated version with some updated musicians. You have Hector Dujon with and Octa Clark with Mike Doucet and David Doucet, who are, of course, the core part of Beausoleil, the young Cajun group that's come along. You know, they live about, 7-8 miles apart. They're all really close down around Lafayette. And they were performing there at the Louisiana State Capitol, mingling politics and culture a little bit for us, helping us promote what is genuinely great about Louisiana culture, doing the old two-step with twin fiddles. And it's kind of a nice sound to hear that outdoors in Louisiana.
What has happened recently is that Cajun food and kind of a Cajun cuisine and the Cajun culture has reached out to a wider audience.
Right.
And I'm just curious what your reaction and also the reaction of the Cajuns, as you've seen it, is to things like the Cajun chef on television, which is I'm even blanking on his name, even though
you're probably thinking of you don't mean Paul Prudhomme,
No.
It'll come to me. And the Justin Wilson.
Yeah, right. Who is known more as a kind of an Uncle Tom character, you know,
right.
Uncle Remus version of Cajun
right.
humor. Equivalent in Cajun humor, and is now, you know, ooh-wee, and is always drinking on the show and is talking in a mock, you know, mo better, this and that,
right.
you know, in sort of a dirt farmer thing. I mean, how do you react to that, and how do the people of Louisiana?
Well, there's a lot of ambivalence about it, I think. Justin Wilson specifically, there are a lot of people that just think, you know, that's terrible at what he's doing. And on the other hand, there are a certain number of people who are not that highly conscious of the whole situation who don't have strong feelings about it and kind of like him and feel like, oh, well, he's getting the food out. He's not a Cajun himself. He's from near Baton Rouge, from Hammond. So that's all just put on accent. He grew up around some of it. You know, a lot of Anglos and Cajuns have mixed in the oil fields in these small towns. And so there's mutual sort of imitation going on all the time. But in general, I saw a little political cartoon about a year ago where these two rural Cajuns supposedly are standing in the downtown streets of Lafayette, and, you know, there's Cajun bank, Cajun bar, Cajun food, Cajun hot dog, Cajun French fries, Cajun everything that really is not Cajun is labeled Cajun, and they're saying, you know, I wish it, I kind of liked it better before no one cared about us. There is ambivalence about the culture being exploited and turned into nothing but kind of a, you know, a little spice, you know, everyone you hear about a little bit of spice. There's outright hooting in some cases, like Paul Prudhomme, the immensely popular chef who was, you know, is from Cajun Louisiana, moved to New Orleans, does a little bit of Cajun, a little bit of the New Orleans haute cuisine, as well as his own personal thing. I mean, a lot of country Cajuns think the idea of blackening redfish is so patently absurd as to be almost crazy. Because they think you're messing up a perfectly good fish. And it's a very idiosyncratic thing he did that is now projected as Cajun food. Likewise, a lot of times I noticed all these ads for the Super Bowl and various newspapers are talking about football and Cajun food. Well, New Orleans is not a place really for Cajun food. and people tend to mix all this up. And most Louisianians have enough of a laissez-faire attitude to not really worry about it too much. But the people who are fairly conscious about the culture get a little bit tired of seeing it all kind of muddled up and mixed up from the outside and, you know, honorary Cajun this and that. And you know, there's a certain amount of ambivalence about it, I guess you'd have to say. On the other hand, all this outside attention, especially initially, really did help stimulate interest in the culture back home and, you know, make kids that were looking to places like, you know, media centers like New York and Philly and L.A. and wherever else feel that, that hey, maybe we have something here after all. So it's a kind of a funny double reaction you get because people know that the outside attention has helped. But now as it's gotten more and more commercialized, they feel kind of funny about it. And, you know, you have old-time musicians like Octa Clark who are the sources of a lot of this stuff. And they're well-liked locally, but, you know, people around the country, they know Doug Kershaw, you know. They know kind of a stylized version of Cajun. And so, you know, there's always kind of a feeling of sadness that they didn't get the real thing, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Nick Spitzer, I'm Bob Carlin here on WHYY-FM. Why don't we go back to a little more music? This is getting back to some Cajun sounds of a different sort, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's other influences on Cajun music besides the tradition. It didn't just stay that
That's
accordion
right.
and fiddle sound.
That's right. Well, actually, the original sound was the fiddle and unaccompanied ballads, and then the accordion came along with the German settlers in Louisiana and peaked in the 20s. By the 30s and 40s, though, country western and Anglo-Western swing was everywhere on the media, on the records. And there were some great Cajun Western Swing players, people like Harry Schoetz, who we'll hear in a moment, the Hackberry Ramblers. Essentially, what we were going to try and get on with this little segment here is that you've got the Cajuns increasingly becoming Americanized and moving towards the Anglo-rural mainstream, so you hear French C&W music, and then the black Creoles moving more and more towards black American style, and so you hear the Zydeco getting more and more into R&B. So we'll hear a little French C&W and then a little French R&B, I guess you could say.
Okay, this is the Austin Special with Harry Schoetz.
Texas, oh mes chers chéris, on va avoir un bon temps, moi et toi, et puis, oh mais quand t'as fait, tu m'as laissé pour t'en aller dans grand Austin, Texas. Toi, tu m'aimes moi, on me cherche, chérie. Et petite, on se connaît sans pas
Thank you. the church bazaar or the baseball game, at the French La La, it's all the same. You want to have fun, now you got to go way out in the country to the Zydeco, and let the bon ton roule, and let the mule pulle. Now don't you be no pulle.
What was that we just heard, Nick?
Oh, that's Bon Temps Roulé, Good Times Roll, Clarence Garlow, in around 1950. It's an important record in the history of Zydeco, because it, on one hand, it has a very Caribbean sound, reminds you of the Professor Longhair. On the other hand, it's sung in English, and it's really about Zydeco more than being Zydeco. It's not, doesn't have much of a French sound to it. It's more of the Caribbean, and it's part of that whole Houston scene, which is very Afro-Caribbean and less French. But it began to get people back into that kind of music. There had been a big gap from the 30s to the 40s in Cajun and Creole music, with an interest in moving away from tradition, much more R&B. And that stream continued. Clifton Chenier picked up on the very R&B French thing. But this song kind of piqued people back into at least the new Zydeco, which was going to be some French, some R&B all mixed together. And that's a classic song. Garlow never did a whole lot more. He had a few follow-ups to that. He said he didn't want to make it in the record world because he said it's a dog-eat-dog world and he didn't like the taste of dog. Remember that quote.
That's a wonderful comment.
Yeah, really, really. But anyway, back-to-back with Harry Schotz there, you know, two performers that went into Texas, which is, of course, next to Louisiana, and was a place that Creoles and Cajuns migrated to the big city, Houston, and sometimes even on to Austin in the case of Harry Schotz. And it meant more contact with American mainstream culture. And so those songs show, you know, effect of mainstream American regional pop quasi-folk music.
Why don't we follow that in rapid succession with a cut by the by Clifton Chenier, the acknowledged king of Zydeco music.
Yeah, that's right. Clifton goes here back to tradition, and he is going to be doing something that is the name of the song that gave the name to the music, Zydeco et pas salé, which means snap beans, no salt. I believe it refers to hard times when people say, well, you know, you're going to plant your beans and harvest them this year, and you'd say, yeah, mais les haricots sont pas salés. I'm going to bring my beans in, but I don't even have meat to flavor them, no salt in the beans. And this is Clifton doing it on the big accordion, but going back to the old original. And you'll hear more of that old Caribbean sound in some of this, too, and I think we've got some more Caribbean to follow that.
C'est tout que tu as magnifique, hein? Allons des haricots, hein? We'll be right back.
Clifton Chenier there, playing The Snap Beans Are Not Salty.
Yeah.
Nick, you're on the staff of the Smithsonian now as a folklorist. How in a brief description, if you can, first off, what's your job there, and how does the Smithsonian view the role of having folklorists on a museum or institutional staff?
Well, maybe I could start at the general level.
They're
very interested in the preservation of cultural tradition in the United States and throughout the world. The Smithsonian as a museum, it preserves traditionally artifacts, but I think we've moved from artifact to event in not just the Smithsonian but many museums in the last few years. And that means we're talking about behavior, we're talking about communities and whole cultures. And I think the Folklife program in particular views the whole world in a sense, not as a museum, because there's a sense of staticness, I suppose, in that kind of concept, but it's interested in cultural conservation. That's sort of the major operative style we go about things with. We're interested in not just the instruments, but the players of the instruments and the way the players of the instruments farm and how they eat and how they live. And there's an underlying feeling that cultural diversity is basically important to our sense of the present, the past, and the future. It gives us all a feeling of cultural continuity out of the past and into the future. And so the Folklife program particularly does a festival each year, the Smithsonian Festival of American Folklife, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware of. And that happens now each summer, 2 weeks around the 4th of July. And countries are featured, states are featured, topics are featured. That's always going on. There are also a number of films that are produced out of the office. So there's been a film on Pullman car porters and their work, Miles of Smiles, and there's been a film on Finnish winter festivals, and a film on fishmongers and things like that. And so we use all available means possible to try and document culture and present culture to a broader audience and hope that the echo will go back to the communities from which the documents come. A few years ago, the former secretary of the Smithsonian, Dylan Ripley, said, take the instruments out of the cases and let them sing. Well, of course, instruments don't sing themselves. At least I've never known any that did. Maybe in some traditions people believe the instruments sing. But the point is that what he wanted to see was that it not just be artifacts, but that it be people with artifacts and the behaviors and whole aesthetic systems. And so that's what our concern is. Specifically, I've been involved in a number of projects. I'm looking at doing some media work and film work, continuing stuff I've done in radio and film and on record before. I'll also be helping on the Folk Festival. This year we're featuring the state of Tennessee, which is a very rich one to work with. We've got everything from old-time country and rockabilly to Memphis blues and jug band type music and other things. Also, the country featured is Japan, so there's a lot of richness there. Interestingly, Japan invested in Tennessee, so there'll probably be some strange crossovers, I suppose, Nissan workers getting together in some way or another. The other area that we deal with is an area I mentioned before, cultural conservation, which really informs all our work, but the feature in cultural conservation is the traditional crafts this year, looking at how craft marketing and loss of, say, environments that provide craft materials has affected the production of crafts. So the festival in many other ways are ways that we work, and I'm involved in all those things in different kinds of levels, I suppose you'd say.
I've been speaking with Nick Spitzer, who's on the staff of the Smithsonian Institution and was for 6.5 years the state folklorist for Louisiana. He also was a voice on the radio here in the early 1970s, first on WXPN and later on WMMR. I've allowed Nick free rein to choose some music of the Gulf Coast, and I want to thank him for coming down here today and pulling out some of his favorite Gulf Coast sounds. We're going to go out with two records, which you get to explain, Nick, they fit together.
Well, you know, I keep talking about the Caribbean, and we haven't really even played any Caribbean music, but I thought maybe if we went with a little bit of Caribbean pop music alongside a little bit of Louisiana pop music, we could establish a connection. Reggae music, in part, evolved from people in Jamaica listening to transistor radios in the 50s and 60s when the transistor technology came along, and hearing American rhythm and blues, mainly out of Miami and New Orleans, and especially New Orleans, which was a tremendous center and still is for rhythm and blues and such. And Fats Domino was one of the people they listened to, and they listened to Professor Longhair. So these pianists who were themselves influenced by Caribbean style because Louisiana had always absorbed that through the migrations into the area were feeding it back and feeding back the American version. So what we're going to do is give you Toots and the Maytals doing Pressure Drop and then Fats Domino doing Let the Four Winds Blow, and kind of listen to the way the beats fit together.
You're the best. Might you understand? I want a girl like you. Tell my troubles to you. Don't be afraid. You heard what I said. Let the four winds blow. Let them blow, let them blow. From the east to the west, I love you the best. Let the four winds blow. Let them blow, let them blow. From the east to the west, I love you the best.